Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the candle in my wind. Where'd you get that from, David T?
It was just a new direction I came up with yesterday, Mr. Plato. How are you?
I'm all right, mate. How are you?
Good, thank you very much. Excited about today because we have somebody very, very special. Somebody who we've been on the tail of for some time.
Well, I've known him for donkeys. About 40 years, I reckon. Well, no, is it 50? Because we were just chatting yesterday. We are middle-aged, proper.
Don't say anything because it's a surprise who the guest is.
Yeah. Right now, Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. So then, Dave, our guest today. Well, he's a journalist. He's a television presenter. He's a mechanic, a writer, according to Wikipedia. And it's fair to say that he just about has the best job in the world. He's known for being, you know, reasonably fond of cars, bikes and machines in general. Mm-hmm. And that's why we booked him for the show. It's me old mate, the one and only Mr. Richard Hammond.
Yay!
Hello. All right, team, how are we? Nice to see you.
Welcome. Genuinely, Mr. Hammond, we've been after you. We're now on series 5 of this award-winning podcast, and we've been after you for a long time. So it's very nice to finally have you sat in our virtual studio with us.
Well, you haven't chased me that hard, because to be quite honest, what happened was JP there sent me a text going, Rich, mate, you're going to be on my chat? Yeah, all right. When? That was it. So in terms of... Do not open as like a private investigators agency or missing persons, because it took one text. I was like, yeah, so, mate,
are you thinking that JPPI is not a viable proposition?
No, it's not. It's not going to roll. It's just not going to roll. It's quite distinctive. Right, it's quite distinctive. Plus, when he was trying to follow anybody, he'd be too damn close. I mean, that's absolutely guaranteed. Imagine that. Imagine I have had him on my tail, and do not take that the wrong way. But that driving behind, no, nobody wants that. You're not allowed to spin them off into the weeds. Right, I found him. No, Jace, you knocked him off the road. No,
you know what? I've done over the years a few little driving things with coppers. You know, you do these like charity events, and I want to become their chief instructor on how to get rid of villains on the road, because we could get them in the trees dead easy, couldn't we?
Yeah, there's a number of reasons, Jason, why that shouldn't happen. it's not popular, that sort of thing. All right, Cuff, hang on, I'm going to just nudge his tail light. I've seen you do it in racing, and do not deny it, rubbing his racing, etc. I should explain, Dave, and this because Jason and I do go back a long way. I was working at Renault UK in the press office, my only grown-up job in 35 years of work. So I've worked in the media. No offense, that's not really a job. It's not really a job. But for 35 years, I took a 1 year and 18 month break simply because I was starving to death in radio. I mean, I was just hungry. My credit card was full. My overdraft was full. I'd sold my motorcycle. There was nothing. I tried selling my body.
Didn't work.
So I applied for and got a job at Rennie UK with a guy you know well, Jason, or knew well, bless, Tim Jackson, officially the nicest man in the whole business, I think. The very best, the honey monster himself. And I went down for my job interview. I borrowed my girlfriend's car and I drove down to the job interview. I borrowed a suit off my brother, but I had a pair of shoes and I'd bought them from TK Maxx.
and they had... We've got a website now.
Well, I was sitting talking to Tim Jackson, having this meeting about, right, so you want to be a press officer? Yes. What do you know about being a press officer? Oh, lots. Nothing. and I thought he was listening to what I was saying and taking copious notes. And I learned subsequently that, no, what he was doing was sketching my shoes because they had laces and buckles on. And he found that so fascinating. He turned around to his assistant after I'd left. Did you see his shoes? And held up the picture. That was it. That was the impression I made on him. But for some reason, the mad but lovely old fool gave me the job. So I was working at Renault UK. But Tim used to be in charge of, in terms of PR, I think, the motorsport side of it. And that was his passion.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what he loved more than anything else. So I was there as the worst press officer in the world ever. when Jason joined as a driver, peddling around initially in the Spiders.
Yes, right, yes.
I remember that
Yeah.
I remember thinking, who's this Herbert? Oh, yeah, he can drive a bit.
Mate, do you remember? It was in that Spider year in 96. We ended up going down, I think we're at Bewley Motor Museum.
It's possible.
And we were there and we just laughed because we were basically trying to skive, but you know, to get out of all the jobs we had to do that day. We were outside just giggling and giggling all day long about, I don't know what.
All you had to do was drive around and all I had to do was try and find press releases that I'd written badly and hand them out to journalists who didn't want to read them. And then Jason moved on. It's great. This is your history, mate.
You can't it's unbelievable.
I was there.
It's not a podcast about you at the minute.
Yeah. You were promoted onto the touring cars. So that was Laguna and Alain Menu and you. Alain Menu, very sexy, very cool Frenchman, and then you. Were driving. And everyone was scared. And I used to have to do the PR. I was there. I would take journalists to the touring car meets. I didn't know what was going on. So I was standing there in the room with all the journalists. I could never remember any of their names.
What sort of year is it? Are we mid-90s?
Yeah, mid-90s. Was it? Yeah. So this must have been, so I was only there for 18 months. Yeah. And so I would take the journalists. I'd go with the journalists. I couldn't remember their names, which was my job. And I wasn't very good at hosting, which was my job. And I didn't know what was going on in the racing, which was my job. And I'd see Jason hooning around the track, wreaking destruction everywhere he went, which some of the journalists and some of our clients were like, hey, jolly good. Some were, oh no, that's not good for the Renault name. It appears to be driven by a maniac. And it was. So that's how we're tied together, you see. Actually, I can go further if you want.
Well, I mean, is it broadcastable or not?
Yep. Because you see Jason's face there.
TV stuff now. Yeah,
Right. He was a racing driver, enjoying a good career as a racing driver. Doing reasonably well for a lunatic as a racing driver. Remembered which way to go around the track and to leave at least one car drivable to race against. That's his approach.
Yeah.
I'd only joined Renault UK with the intention of saying, right, I can't afford to live in radio anymore, much as I love it. I want to get into TV. I want to do cars TV. If I get to work at Renault, I'll get to know the editors of all the motoring programs and eventually maybe snag a job. And I did, through a guy called Peter Baker. Another of the key figures in my life saved me, gave me a job on Granada Men and Motors. It was, if you're not, you won't be, of course you don't. It was a sort of an intellectual platform for socio-political debate and discussion, disguised as cars up to 9 o'clock and then sort of topless darts after that. It was pretty fast. So I'd been doing that for, I think the max I ever got him to was £125 a day.
Okay.
I didn't have a car. I couldn't afford a car. Mm-hmm. So I used to rent from Wendover, where I lived then. The cheapest car you could rent was a purple Nissan Micra Mark II. And it had £25 a day rent me in yellow on the side. And I used to use that to go off and record these quite inexpensive car films with a director who would have had the car for a week.
And in Manchester then, presumably, if it's Granada Men and Motors. Yes.
Yes. And I'd turn up and he'd say, right, what are you going to say? Well, I haven't driven the car. You've had it for a week. Well, anyway, action. And I'd have to try and do something on it. And this is all to try and advance my career and to, you know, the next big thing. And then Driven was the first time, wasn't it, Jason?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And I'd been to audition for Driven and I thought, oh, I've been called to audition. This is a network show, national budget.
Big time.
Proper cameras, right? Because we had my mate Sid, who had the camera. He had one bag when we went on car launches, and in that bag he had a camera, his pants and socks and anything he could nick from the hotel bedroom.
I remember Sid.
Well, so he would have the camera on his shoulder. We didn't even have radio mics. We had a wire between the camera and me, which I pinned to my shirt. So I couldn't go more than 5 feet from him. We couldn't go either side of a car. That was my world. Then I got the audition for Driven, and I thought, this is it, Hammond.
Yeah. Mate, do you remember where it was? We both turned up on the same day. Do you remember?
Yep. But really, the main thing I remember, Jason, is who got the job. And it wasn't me, of the two of us, it wasn't me, and it was you.
Yeah.
I think, I did have a go,
You did have a go. You had a go.
Do you remember, we were in the bar somewhere on a car launch, and I had a go.
Can I just jump in for a second? At this point, please, where you both turned up for the interview for Driven, Presumably, you had assumed that there were two roles going, i.e. one for each of you, and you didn't know that you were both competing for the same position, or did you?
No, I think we knew there was one.
There was one gig because Jason Barlow had left, hadn't he? He'd gone to Top Gear. Yes. Yes. And it was Penny Mallory, Mike Brewer, and a new person, which was going to be either. And I didn't know Richard was turning up for the screen test, and Richard didn't know I was too.
But what? Just getting some, from my point of view, this is my world. I've stepped back into my world, broadcast. Yeah. Yeah. He's a racing
driver. He's already got a good job.
Yeah. But like me turning up for a seat at Williams and us doing a bit of testing and me bloody getting it. And he'd have been quite miffed. And it was that. So, yeah, he got it. And I did on a press launch that I was filming out with my mate Sid with his one bag with his socks, pants, camera and stolen wine from the hotel in. And him with an enormous TV crew, lots of people around. Oh, Jason, that was really so good. Well done. Really so good. It was just incredible, Jason. It was really brilliant. And I did have a go, didn't I? I did.
Yeah. I mean, it was awkward for a little bit, wasn't it?
It was. It was awkward. We didn't talk. Yeah. I think it's come back to me. I think, Jason, what I said was something like, oh, well, that's just brilliant, isn't it? I mean, if they're auditioning for a new airline pilot, they generally have somebody who's flown a plane before, not somebody who's just a racing driver or a typist. And I made a bit of a scene.
So at this point then,
quite embarrassed,
in the story.
I am quite embarrassed about that, by the way. It's quite brave of me to confess it, I think. Don't you agree?
Well, do you know what? I can add a bit of good feeling to it because I basically got the gig because I was good mates with both Mike and Penny away from motor racing, away from TV world.
Yeah.
So, and I remember thinking towards the end of the day, thinking, oh, mate, this is not going to happen because Richard's much better on camera, much better presenter than I was, done radio, done media. And like Richard says, I was just winging it. Do you know what I mean? And it came off because I knew those two and they wanted me as a bit of fun as, you know, what Driven was then, the three of us. And that's how I got the gig, not because I was better than you. That's
how long was it awkward for?
I'm still pretty awkward about it now. It's in here. It's bad.
It was a couple of years, I would say. And then it got really awkward because Driven was very successful in the day. It was the biggest network show and it blew Top Gear off air. And Top Gear went off air. They had this big rethink about what they were going to do. Driven changed its format whilst Top Gear was off air, and we went to a live studio audience in a massive big hangar, very much like Top Gear turned into. Anyway, we just, prior to this, I remember going for a screen test down Western Avenue for the new Top Gear with Jeremy.
I went
to a big studio on West, just almost opposite.
I remember the auditions. I went to the same one.
Do you remember it? I went to that audition and I knew you were going for it, obviously. And I'm thinking, I hope they don't. I hope we're not there at the same time. Because I was trying to keep it quiet from Driven. I didn't want them to know.
I would have told them immediately.
Yeah. So
I've been called by my agent, Kate Moon, who said, Richard, they're auditioning for a new series of Top Gear. And I'm like, oh, this is it, finally, brilliant. Having nearly got it once before in the John Bentley days. John Bentley. Well, he used to run Top Gear, and I was in the pub in Cheltenham with my wife, still working on Granada Men and Motors. He was a rising star in Channel 4 Driven, doing things I could only ever dream of doing. My phone rang out the blue. Oh, hello, Richard. It's John Bentley, Top Gear. Oh, hello, John. How are you? Right. I think it's about time we got you on our show. Should you want to come down and have a chat? And I went, yeah, when? Well, tomorrow? Fine, I'll be there. I hung up and just burst into tears. I thought, this is it. It's happening, finally. I drove into Birmingham, saw John Bentley. Right, I think he's very good, Richard. I heard your tapes. We'll try out the next series. Brilliant. Thank you so much, John. Then he got fired.
He went to fifth gear.
I don't know if he was fired, but he left and went to fifth gear and took with him my ambitions to be on Top Gear the first time round.
So the Top Gear Audition Mark II comes around. You go to the studios in London, just off Western Avenue. You are unbeknown to the fact that that Jason has also been there, maybe before or afterwards. But then what? But then what happened?
I've blown the audition. I'd have just been this angry little brummer. Right, well, if anybody there give the job, I'm not doing it. I don't need to talk to Jerry.
I can remember saying to Jezza, please, look, just keep this quiet because I don't, you know, please, I don't want this to get out. I know. I didn't know him that well at the time. but yeah, and you know, the right man got the gig. I didn't, and the right man got the gig, which was Rich. So I went back to fifth year. No, I went back to Driven. And then Top Gear blew us off the air.
And is this 2002, Richard?
About then we started putting it together in 2000, 2001. And I can't remember when it came to it. I mean, I'd got a call from my agent, Kate Moon, who just said, Richard, they want to see you for Top Gear. They're auditioning for a new series. Ooh, I was still at Granada Men and Motors renting the little purple Nissan Micra whenever I needed to go anywhere. And she said, look, then you're not going to get it. It's going to go to a woman, I think. You're not going to get it. But you should go and make some good contacts. And I went and did a piece to camera, as you did, Jason, the same audition, bit with Jeremy, mopped up a bit of the news. Excuse the noise at this end, by the way. I am in my workshop.
That's all right.
It means there's actually something going on. What they're doing is slamming the door to go and eat their lunch. and so I was told I would never get it, but I met Richard Porter, scriptwriter. And a whole load of the original people that were with the show and stayed with us for 20-odd years. And I remember getting in the car and thinking, oh, God, they're going to have such a brilliant time doing that show and I'm not going to be part of it. In actual fact, the only reason I got the gig, and they'll always tell you this, they're very happy to tell you. At the time, I had managed to get enough money together to buy my own car, which was a 1982 Porsche 911 SC left-hand drive, completely knackered. Now, quite a valuable car, actually. Now, a proper old-school G-series gearbox.
Have you still got it? 911.
No. It was absolutely ruined. But I managed to coax it all the way into London from Cheltenham. So that had caught their eye first. And then I did the audition, and it went quite well. And then I said, right, anyway, it's been great seeing you. Thank you. I've got to go back to the NAM, Cheltenham. Mm. And Jeremy always says that's why him and Wilman gave me the job. So me saying, got to go back to the NAM, Cheltenham, got me the Top Gear job. And me wearing a pair of boots with laces and buckles in got me the job at Renault that led eventually to get the job. So it's just shambolic and lucky. No talent or skill.
How long was the gap then between you leaving the auditions, thinking in your own mind, that would be amazing, but unfortunately I'm not going to get this job, much as I would love it. How long until you then get, is it a phone call? Do they ask you back in?
Months and months. I didn't hear anything. And I was sitting in the basement of a little house in Cheltenham. And again, my wife was, the basement was where I had my office. It was very damp. So we're sitting at my little desk with me trying to work and scavenger living. I was doing a bit of writing and script writing for Men and Motors. And Mindy was with me and the phone rang. And it was, we were talking off air about those old telephones with the one of those. And so it didn't have a number on it. And I just looked at the phone and said to Mind, that's them. I just knew it was. I answered the phone and Gary Hunter, who's, you remember Gary Hunter? He was the exec producer of Series 1 and 2. Yeah. Scotty, hello, Richard. Oh, hello, Gary. That's Gabby talking here. Oh, good. Would you like to join our team? What? You've got the job? Yes. Thank you. And then I put the phone and burst into tears again. And then I rang him back. He'd given me his number. I had to ring him back and say, the little brummy fella, are you sure? Yes. What do we do now then? Well, come in and see us next week. Okay, thank you. Then I went upstairs with Mindy. It was 11 in the morning. And we've all been there when you've got a bottle of champagne that you've kept. You know, there's a stage in your life where if you get a bottle of champagne, it's like, hang on to that, baby, for a moment. Well, So I've been on
not drinking that yet.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You sort of look at it and think, is this a big, birth of a child? It's kind of a big moment, but there's bigger moments. It will save it.
Yeah.
And so I said to Min, shall we open the champagne? And we did. And we sat on the little wall in the back of our house in Tivoli Street and drank the champagne at 11 in the morning. And I just said, Min, I think this will change everything. And it did.
Wow. But again, how cool is that?
Blind luck. Just because I said,
well, you say that. You say, You say that. It's not luck, mate. It's perseverance and being out there and you know, and never giving in. That's what it is. But yes, we all need a bit of luck, but you made it happen.
You'll get that because of racing, and racing is so similar. It's incredible. Mm. It staggers me all the time that you can get two drivers of equal talent. One of them will have the application. We forget how much of their time has to be spent just battling to get a seat, battling to get a sponsorship, battling to get that ride, and being prepared to go that extra mile and do it. And it goes beyond being good at it. So I started in 1988 at BBC Radio York. And there were, you know, any number of us started in the same year. I still talk to some of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm the one who enjoyed everybody else's luck. And it is that. It is... Luck often comes at 2:30 in the morning when you happen to be still at the station editing a piece for the following day. Yes, because that is when you get somebody come and go, oh, no, the breakfast presenter's not very well. Will you do it, Rich? Yeah, all right, I'll do it. So you have to have the application, but you need the luck as well if that doesn't come. Yeah. Some of the best drivers, some of the best radio and TV presenters, some of the best whatevers have never been discovered because it didn't quite go right. One little decision, one little thing didn't quite fall into place.
Don't you think it's all, you know, don't you think it's all to do with fate, though, as well, in so much as had you not had the disappointment of the driven job, which you didn't get, then, you know, things would... But
leave it, Dave. Just leave it. Let it go, Dave. Let it go.
Just put it away.
That's clearly.
Yeah, but if you think about it, my response to that was to carry on, to knuckle down and to keep going. Now, why was that? Probably because I was pursuing something that was available to me through a career in the media that wasn't available anywhere else. That's why it mattered. Yeah. But why was that? Yeah. Probably something to do with my childhood. You can trace it all back to the choice of style of booties you wore as a baby. It might be that. So any one of us...
Did they have buckles and laces, those boots?
They probably did. That probably set the tone. Yeah. That's what it was. Ultimately, that led to me getting the job at Renault, that blah de blah. No, I think life is, for all of us, the most incredible collection of coincidences. Don't forget, it requires a colossal coincidence for us to still be alive, for us to happen at all. Yeah. It really does. And so careers are founded on a blend of application. Yes, some skill or latent talent, but also just blind luck and things fall in the right way. And that luck doesn't just extend to somebody ringing you out of the blue and saying, would you like to go on X Factor, and you winning it and starting a career. That luck goes way before that, because what was it that happened in your life that made you prepared to go out and try it, to go out and do it, to get into that racing car? And I mean, it's terrifying, but to do it, what drove you to do that? Something happened to you in your psyche as a kid that meant you were sitting on the grid, terrified like everybody else, and I don't want to do this, I don't want to, this is terrifying, I'm going to do it, and made yourself do it. And whatever it was that made yourself do it, that's where the luck was. That's where it lies.
Yeah.
No, I'd agree with that. We all need our fair share of sprinkling of good fortune.
Yeah, and it's where it comes. It comes in the most unexpected ways, is my point, is that it isn't always, the luck isn't just a random telephone call out of the blue saying, hey, would you like to drive for us, Jason? It's something way back that led to you having the resistance, the wherewithal, the strength, the inclination to go in a particular direction, possibly entirely unconnected from what happened that was fortunate, but the luck started years before then. So there's no point looking. You might have already passed the moment. It might have already happened.
The luck could be the thing that has physically pushed that door open for you. But once you get in there, though, you've then got to make of that what you can, you know. And in both of your instances, well, in all of us, I mean, you know, we can all cite luck as being, you know, the thing that got us here. But we've all had to sort of have that opportunity and then make it for so long. And that's the crucial bit, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, it is. But again, the luck is in being a person inclined to do whatever it took to do at that moment to take advantage of opportunity. I think luck and opportunity are different. They really are. Opportunity comes along, grab it. And it's lucky if you happen to be inclined to make a go of it at that particular moment. The stars have to align.
Richard, then, so after so many years on Top Gear and so many wonderful memories, would I be right in thinking that the trips, the specials are the ones that are most dear to you? Are those the fondest memories?
Yes and no. I mean, yeah, they're fond because God, I never thought I'd get the chance to do that. It's like I never had the ambition to travel. I'm from Birmingham. People from Birmingham don't expect to travel. It's like we don't ski or swim very well. It's for other people. So I didn't expect any of that to end up in a Bolivian rainforest or the North Pole or wherever else. So yeah, they're fabulous and people love them. It's why we concentrated on doing those. But no, I've got really fond memories of the early days, right back to the initial conversation when we first started the show together up at White City, when we all sat round in the production office, and you'll both know this, how a show goes in a different direction. So we all sat down, right, ground rules. So there's me, Wilman, Jeremy, Jason Dore was the other presenter before James joined, and Richard Porter, Roland French, all of which names you're nodding because you know them all. Mm. They were all there in the room, and we said, right, let's set the ground rules for this new relaunch Top Gear. First of all, no supercars, just ordinary cars that people can actually buy. And secondly, no foreign travel. Let's just do ordinary cars that people can actually buy in places.
Yeah. Here comes the tangent. Here it comes.
Oh, boy. We didn't stick to that in the end. Not out of self-interest. It's because we quickly realized, wait a minute, I think people who want just straight dry information on drag coefficients or recommended tire choice or whatever. That information is information. And increasingly, it is available on your telephone. You know, I started in radio. If I wanted to find something out, I went to the library because that's what you did. Yeah. But now it's there. So we realize that information is available. What we need to do is bring these things to life, and that's with human stories. And so that's when we quickly realize, the more evocative and emotive cars and experiences in them is what will chime with people. And we were lucky indeed.
Right. And we really were lucky. Boy, did it ever chime.
I know, it got out of hand, didn't it? That's a piece of serendipity, to use a multi-syllable word. I'll write it down for you, Dave. It was a joyous piece of serendipity because it meant that at that particular moment, there was an appetite globally for a show featuring three. I mean, look, as we're none of us Brad Pitt, are we, the three of us? We're not.
Yeah, but that was what it was all about. But that, I think that is exactly what it was all about, because it was three ordinary blokes who were not pin-ups in any way. And it's all about relatability, isn't it? You know, that was what it was. Yeah. It was a show for the ordinary men and women at home, presented by people who were relatable.
And I think as well, we were laddish, but in the sense I sort of remember it from old, not in the modern meaning of that, because we weren't laddish. People would make the wrong assumptions. The number of times, I don't know if you've ever had anything like it said, but people would come up to me and say about Top Gear, oh, well, we know what you lot are like about women drivers, eh? Mm-hmm. What have we ever said? What? We've never said it. But people would imbue us with those qualities even when we didn't do it. But it found a huge global audience. It took us by surprise. It took the BBC by surprise. I think sometimes it took the audience by surprise. It was just the time was right. They wanted a show like that, not just in the UK, but in South Africa, Australia, Russia, China, wherever we went.
So I guess when that came to an end, that was pretty tough, eh?
Yeah, it was. It was a end of an era, but we knew we had to stick together. I mean, I was there, by the way, and I've said this, I'm on record as saying this, I was there, and it wasn't a proud moment for anybody, but Jeremy wasn't fired. He simply wasn't, they didn't renew his contract for the next year.
But
the decision was made, we're going on. It was, I thought, well, this is a good opportunity, if nothing else. Whilst looking at my house thinking, this is going to get expensive to run, really. And looking at my two girls in their nice private school uniforms, oh, this is all going to really hurt. Ooh. So we sat them down, Mindy and I, and said, right, guys, you need to know. I know people have mentioned it at school, but my job's gone. And, that's where the money comes from. We haven't got a money tree in the garden. So we were very honest with them, and we told them that, I need to find something else to do now, or things could have to change. I don't want to worry you guys. Mm. We'll all be fine. Mm. But things could have to change. I wanted them to learn that money has to be got. It doesn't just arrive. It arrived pretty bloody easily for me, let's be honest. But it nevertheless, I had to do something for it. My eldest daughter, Izzy, really took that on board. James had come over after we'd finished the show. James had come over to stay with me for a few days. We were chatting. And we'd gone to Kentucky Fried Chicken to go and get lunch for everybody, just him and me. We'd driven up in my old vintage LeConda, as I recall, with Izzy. And we'd got to the front of the queue, put our order in. It came time to pay. And James typically said, oh, I'll pay, Hammond. No, mate, I'll pay. No, I'll pay. There was a pause. And just when the whole restaurant had gone quiet, Izzy said, well, technically, lads, I should pay because you haven't got a job between you. and the place detonated.
Oh, good stuff.
People let it. She obviously then thought, oh, yeah, this is the best game. So subsequently, end of the queue in Morrison's. I'm at home, so I'm doing the shopping. As I was waiting to pay, she would say very loudly, Daddy, she sounds quite posh, Daddy, yes. So when does your credit card stop working? Oh, for God's sake. And again, a whole store full of people in hysterics. It was, it she loved that game. But I wanted them to come with us on that voyage. They needed to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of the fact that it doesn't just, you know, sort of appear by magic like my 15-year-old daughter seems to think that it does.
they needed to know that they've been privileged and that privilege can go away. It's not permanent. You don't
absolutely
have the right to go to a nice school and have money for a nice car.
What was the period of time then between, obviously, the now famous, infamous end of Top Gear and then the rebirth with the Grand Tour? Because in my own mind, it didn't take that long, but I suspect it was longer than I think it was.
I don't know, but I suspect it's longer than I think it was too. I think it was a year or so, or 18 months, maybe two years. I think it was getting on for 2 years. I mean, Amazon worked for us because they were looking to establish themselves in territories around the world in which we were already established. We'd been doing our live stage shows.
Yeah.
The show was already watched. So Australia, all sorts of places that they wanted to get to, which made us very valuable to them, which made them more inclined to throw simply vast buckets of money at us to make the show. So again, what have I said all along? That's a piece of luck that started how long ago?
Yeah.
When Amazon decided, hey, let's go into TV, or before then? Mm. Coincided at that moment, Amazon wanted something with global reach. We could supply it. So we were lucky.
Richard, we can't talk about Top Gear and the 20 or so years that, you know, that was of your life without talking about the crash. Fortunately, I saw something the other day, actually, where you revisited the vampire dragster, indeed, and you could see how emotional the whole thing was. Obviously, life-changing for you. Fortunately, not physically life-changing, but certainly mentally life-changing. At the risk of oversimplifying the process and the lasting effects of that, did it give you a new perspective on life and what's actually important?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it didn't give me magic powers. I'd really hoped it might. You could see through walls. I didn't. But I think spending 6 months or a year or longer sort of questioning your own mental state, your own mind, your own emotional state, yeah, it will do that. But to be fair, so will passing 40, passing 50. And I'm very lucky in that for me, it's now, we've all got moments as big as that in our lives.
Yeah.
The arrival of a first child, or your first marriage, first divorce, loss of a parent, whatever. We've all got those big things that affect us. And that's just added to the long list of mine. But it was, I'm always very cautious not to make too light of it. I don't want to go on and on about it because the last thing I would want is people to go, oh, bloody hell, it's Hammond going on about that accident. Just shut up. Yeah. It's gone. But also, I'm likewise very cognizant of the fact, that's another multisyllable, did you know?
That's a very good word. Serendipity and cognizant in the same show.
I'll write them both down.
Write them both down. Email them to me, please. Yeah.
And context. So you can fire them off without looking at them. Yes, I like
Willy
that.
Willy and Nilly.
He particularly likes a Venn diagram.
I'll do one of them.
But I'll get them wrong though, because I'll talk about cognitivity or something. Sorry, you were saying.
I've forgotten now. For a lot of people, a frontal lobe brain injury, which is what I received, has a very different outcome. Mm. And I spoke to loads and loads of people over the course of the years following my injury. And the fascinating thing was, they can have received that injury. I spoke to returning servicemen and women who'd, you know, they'd received their brain injury because somebody fired a rocket-propelled grenade at their armored personnel carrier. I've spoken to people who received their injury falling off a ladder. I've spoken to people who were mugged. So in other words, it doesn't matter the context, how you receive the injury. The process of recovery is astoundingly similar.
Yeah.
But I was again lucky in that I went a long way down the road. I don't know. I mean, I could still be in a coma, of course.
And living in some weird world.
Which case I've conjured up you two. That's the best my brain can do.
But I saw something the other day on TikTok where you had returned to the famous tree Now, this, am I right in thinking that this is a tree that you had in the Lake District and you had had a dream that you were there walking around this tree and therefore it had the significance, so you then went to revisit it? And actually seeing you sat against this tree in there in your big coat in all weathers and just reflecting on the importance of what that meant to you was very moving, I thought.
Oh, that's kind of you to say. And the reason I made that little film, because, yeah, it was the tree that when I was in a coma, I was on in ICU, life support, blah, blah, blah. And Mindy, my wife, had been told, we're going to lose him. And she'd said, can I do anything? I was having this dream of walking up that particular hill and around that tree. And as I was getting closer to the tree, I was thinking, oh, wait a minute. I think I'm going to be in trouble. Oh, no, I am definitely. I better turn around. And I woke up. And that's when Mindy told me, she'd asked, can I shout at him? And she'd absolutely yelled at me, you dare die. And it worked. And I woke up. It does work. I mean, that's a known state. The coma state is kind of here and there. And I wanted to do that for the same reason. After the crash, Mind and I wrote a book about what happened. And I remember saying to Mind early on, when I was still, I had very little emotional control. I was a mess. But I remember saying to Mind, let's make this a good thing. Let's make this a good thing for us.
A real positive.
And anywhere we can. And we agreed to write the book because we said, look, if it helps a single person or couple or family or friends navigate that path back to some semblance of mental and emotional health, that's a good thing. And it did. We had thousands of messages from people who read it and said it had actually been directly useful. And weirdly, when I did that little video about the tree, it did the same. I got so many messages from people who said, God, that's really comforting because that helps me deal with the loss of my father only 2 months ago. Or that's helped me with my own fear of what happens. Yeah. And I think that's kind of what's doubly gratifying is it was quite a difficult thing to make because it's very personal. And if people have gone, oh, bloody hell, Emma, that's a load of rubbish. Go and drive a Ferrari. Mm. I'd have thought,
it was a lovely little film, actually. Really lovely film.
Well, they were kind about it, which if it resonates, if it means anything to anybody, it's worth doing. That's not to say, you know, I'm a television and radio presenter. That's my job. I do it for money. And it's gone very well. But sometimes you do get to do something and it really does touch people. And you think, oh, well, that's a nice feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And, you know, and I mean,
it's closest we'll come to doing anything that matters.
Yeah, but, you know, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, it shows people that actually there's more to you than just titting around in cars and stuff like that, you know, which is something...
Titting around?
Well, yes, he's talking about our craft, Jason. That's both of us. Titting around in cars. You're a racing driver, me as a presenter, and you as a presenter, titting around.
Very good point, actually. Titting around, I'll buy that.
And like titting around with headphones on. That's a better career. Is it really worthy?
Let us segue beautifully now, I think, because Jason is dying to talk to you about the car history. Jason, from the very beginning.
Well, do you know what? Even though we go back a long time, I don't know where your love of cars came from, because it's clearly there. Where did that start? As a kid, I guess?
Yeah, from my grandfather, my mum's dad, he worked at Jensen. Well, he finished his career at Jensen, but he was a coach builder, so he worked at Mulliners in Birmingham. That's not the one that built all the posh Bentleys. It's the one that built all the rubbish cars. But they were coach built. So he could work wood, metal, leather, aluminium, whatever. So I grew up with a fascination for the machines. And my dad's dad, George Hammond, absolutely fabulous. He was just a lovely, chaotic, disorganized, but adorable man. Looked exactly like John LeMessurier. Remember from Mesurier?
Yeah.
I thought that was him as a kid. What? I just thought, grandpa's on that show because that's him. He loved cars. Never could afford any car you'd want, but loved them. So from those two, really. And I remember at the age of 5, sitting in our sitting room in Birmingham, talking to my dad and working out how many days until I could drive a car, until I could take my test, until I was 17. I actually worked out it was 365 fewer until I could ride a motorbike. So from that point on, I became obsessed with bikes as well. And it just stuck with me. And it still pulls together everything I like, you know, engineering, ingenuity, commercialism, art, expression. Yeah. All of those things. I mean, I genuinely do feel the car is the single most important artifact humankind has ever made because it addresses every single need beyond shelter. Everything we need beyond shelter is about moving from here to there. if you've got, okay, you found yourself a cave to shelter from the rain.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
I'm hungry. I'm hungry. I need to go over there and catch that deer or go and get those leaves. I need a mate. I've got to go over there and find one. I need to be sociable. I want to go to war with them. Whatever you want to do, you've got to move from where you are to where you want to be. And the machine we designed and made and love that enabled us to do that is, I'd say, even more important than shelter, because you can have shelter. What are you going to do in it? Starve to death. It's the car. It's the most important artifact we've ever created. It's why it's... We use it to demonstrate everything about ourselves. It's a form of display, whether that's potent and loud and showy or willfully quiet and humble and under the radar. Yeah. It's still a means of communication. It's a means of transporting us and our loved ones bodily from where we are to what we need. It's the most important thing we've ever done.
It's a really lovely way to look at it, actually. I'm buying that. Mm. I think you're right.
I just think it is. And I think that's why when it came about, it was a novelty. And it was, oh, look, Carruthers is coming up the drive. There's no horse in front of his carriage. This is amazing. Very, very quickly, it went on to shape our landscape, to write our story across the world. And it did. It enabled everything we've done since. And when it's coming up for reinvention now, why it's such a contentious issue is we now appreciate the significance of it. We didn't when it was a novelty for Carruthers to come up the drive without a horse in front of the carriage, but we sure as hell do now. Which is why I'm not anti-electric car, I'm not anti-car sharing or anything, but I firmly believe whatever happens, if through the necessary and inevitable decarbonisation of the transport infrastructure, that's about a million syllables there, Dave, you can have them all. That must happen. But however that ends up expressing itself, whether we are being driven in an autonomous, anonymous, great Tupperware box from where we are to work, to school, to the library, doesn't matter. That's fine. That'll happen. But we still will have some place in our hearts for these fascinating analog machines, these examples of human ingenuity overcoming and harnessing physics, materials to move ourselves bodily from here, from there. You can connect over Zoom, but you can also get there and be there and do it. And to do that, that's what the car's for. It'll never go away for that reason.
What was your first one of these machines then, Mr. Hammond?
Well, I was working at a petrol station in Sherrow Common on the outskirts of Ripon, between Ripon and Harrogate. Right at the end of the road from Ripon to Harrogate, there was our racetrack. It was, I can't remember how long it was, but I remember the record on a motorbike was 7.5 minutes, which meant it was well into three figures the whole way. I wanted an old Capri. I was very lucky. My mum and dad bought me my first car. And we had, I can't remember, it was about 500 quid or something.
Yeah.
I was very excited. We found an old Capri and I really wanted it. But it turned out...
Oh, my God, cool car.
Yeah, well, but my dad reckoned it was a bit hooky, so I didn't get it. So I got a 1976, I think it was, Toyota Corolla liftback. There's one in the Blues Brothers. Ooh. There's one in the Blues Brothers. It was modelled after the Mustang, but a lot smaller and quite a lot crapper. But I loved it. It was epic. It had a push-rod engine, but I adored it. Unfortunately, they bought it me for my 18th, and because of it was available, I got it before my 18th, which meant inevitably I wrote it off before my 18th. It never made it.
Do you know what? I can see that coming.
It never made my 18th birthday, no. Sadly not. I destroyed it. But it was... And before that, you know, because I'd nagged my parents about motorbikes from the age of five, because it was 365 days fewer before I could ride one, they'd said I could have one when I was about five. So, and I just clung to that for the next 11 years. So they had to let me have one. But they didn't ride motorbikes. Nobody we knew rode motorbikes. I'd never seen a motorbike actually ridden up close. So they paid half of it. I paid the other half. It was £200 out of my money picking up chickens' eggs, which was my job at 16. And it was on my 16th birthday. There it was in the yard at the back of our house in Ripon. No side stand. It had snapped off. A Honda MTX 50, which is like an off-road style 50. And I'd had to go to the library and get a book about how to ride a motorbike, because you couldn't just look it up on the internet. There wasn't internet. So it was a book. And I kick this thing, and then it makes a noise. Ding, 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 ding. And then I pull that in clutch. Ding, ding, ding. I put it into gear. Ding, ding, ding. Dunk. Oh, that didn't work. So then I just had to learn from a book how to ride a bike. And the feeling of freedom, of exploding out into the world, brim full of ill-formed and ultimately useless teenage dreams and ideas was absolutely unbeatable, and something I doubt I'll ever recapture. The most exciting moments of my life. Thinking I could go, I could go to Harrogate. I mean, it's 15 miles, it'll take me an hour and a half, and I will be overtaken by bicycles on hills, but it would be quicker to cycle, but I can do it. And I've got keys on the hall table next to the telephone. I put my keys down there. Ching, that's my keys. And those keys represented, that's me out in the world. I'm here.
Yeah, freedom, yeah. That must have been, over the years, an amazing collection of, you know, cars that have gone through the Hammond stable. Yep. Through they've the garages.
Literally.
give us a little taste. But, you know.
I nearly put my Ford Model A through the garage door the other weekend because I hadn't started it in about 7 months. And I thought, this old thing, it's 19, whatever it is. It's a very old vintage car. And I thought, it'll never start. And first button, damn thing started in gear. But because the brake and accelerator are the other way around on it, I briefly forgot where the clutch was in relation to the brake. So I was like, I was stabbing pedals. Will you please let me stop it? As I hurtled towards the garage door. But I did stop it. Yeah, I've had a lot of Porsches. I love a Porsche because they're built to work. You'll know this, Jason. Yeah. The difference between, if you're doing a group test, so if you've got a Ferrari, a Porsche, and a Lamborghini, you ring Ferrari, we send you the car, and you get, it ain't nothing like all you buy. It's like, hang on a minute, and about 15 men to look after it. The Lamborghini, how many horsepower does it have? How many does a Ferrari have? It has 800. Oh, there's 900. Really, does it? Porsche, hello, yes? You just say, I will send it. And it just gets dropped off. And you'll also have found this, the figures claimed for Porsches, in my experience, I can't say it's an absolute, in my experience, they're usually better than what they claim.
Oh, really?
It's usually, it'll be faster, fractionally faster. It's incredible. The difference.
I'd agree with that.
They just, exactly. They'll just say, there it is, up yourself. What, you don't want to hang around? It's just going to work, isn't it? They just leave you to it. And then it'll be quicker to 60, quicker top speed, more economical, and better than they say it is. Only by a bit, but enough.
I mean, there was a time, and it probably, this happened for you, but in the early days of going down to Maranello on a launch, on a car launch, there were chaperones everywhere, and they would not let you out of sight. They'd determine which road you used. Anyway, it took a couple of years before they started to trust us, but they were still always loitering around. And Ferrari, Lamborghini, but the Germans, the Porsche, like Richard says, there's the car, do what you like.
Bring
you back at the end.
Yeah.
So that's why I've always loved them. I've had a lot of Land Rovers, still do. I love classics. I mean, I'm in my little car restoration workshop now. And I do love classics for all the reasons I said earlier. They are an expression. They are nothing encapsulates its time, the needs, wants, visual aesthetics, commercial realities of its time, like a car, given the significance of them to us. Not surprising they express that about us. So I do love classics. I've sold a few that I regret. Ferrari 550 Maranello.
Well, you sold a lot, though, didn't you? Didn't you have almost like a reverse midlife crisis where most people kind of acquire automotive exotica and you got rid of it all?
I got rid of a load, when I was setting this workshop up because I needed to buy a paint oven and a prep bay and all the rest of it. It came to a lot of money. So I sold an old Bentley that I loved, Porsche, a 1969 Porsche 911T, born the same year as me. I regret that. And a Lotus Esprit 350 Sport, which I bought as a classic, but I reviewed when they were new. And then I bought it as a classic subsequently, many years later. So yeah, and a load of bikes. But I sold to spend money so I can restore other people's classic cars.
And that's the smallest cog, is it? That's this business venture that you're doing at the moment.
Yeah, exactly right. Yes. It is the smallest cog, which is with Neil, Anthony, and Andrew Greenhouse. They are a dad, a son, a brother that I've known for years and restored my cars for years. A few years back, Neil said he was going to lose the workshop that he was working out of. They were developing it, and he didn't have the resources at the point to start again. And it was just him and his son doing it. Yeah. So I said, I need you to restore my cars. I'm not Jay Leno. I can't employ you. So let's set up in business. I'll fund us into a new business, and then you can use the spare time to do my cars. And then I thought, that might make a TV show. rather usefully, I also own a production company. So we pitched it and Discovery agreed. And so it's now a TV show. And then Neil's brother, Andrew, joined us. So, yeah, it's a genuine endeavor. It doesn't made any money yet. And having sold all my cars to buy
it. Yet is a crucial word.
Sold most of my cars to buy the kit. I'm still putting money in every month to sustain it, because it turns out new business is really difficult. It just is. It's a difficult one to blag, which is all I've ever done. Blag my way into broadcasting, into PR, into everything I've ever done. And business doesn't respond quite the same way. So, yeah, I'm having a wrestling match with it, but I'll make it work. Determined. I'm a Brummie, you know.
Yeah. It'll be great. It'll be great. So, Richard, look, we always reckon that motoring and music, they're particularly well suited. So I want your fantasy drive. So where are you? Where are you going to? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you in?
Right. I'm at the top of the Honister Pass in the Lake District, which is sort of the top of the Borrowdale Valley, heading down towards Batemir, because it's my favourite place in the world. And actually, that is a spectacularly beautiful road. Yeah. It's not an entirely dry road on the day. Little bit of a challenge. But I do know there's nothing coming. I know there's nothing coming the other way. And there's nothing behind me because I am in a seriously hot Subaru Impreza WRX.
Oh, wow. Good lad.
Yeah, proper, really, in a fairly angry state of tune with a really cross set of cams in it. So it doesn't want to idle. It's pretty peaky. It's pretty angry. And I'm listening to Iggy Pop, Lust for Life, driving hell for leather down Honister Pass to the Bridge Hotel at the end. Well, I shall drop the keys off and jump into the bar.
Have a stiff drink to calm down.
Oh, yeah, exactly right. And then just say a lot. You should have seen that. Nobody could have done that. It was amazing. A bit of that. Yeah.
Perfect.
And on that note, JP, I think you need to take us out.
Well, unfortunately, that's it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, big thanks to you. But a huge thanks to our very special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Richard Hammond. Thanks, pal.
Mate, absolute pleasure. Really good to see you again. Talk to you soon.
And I'm glad it's not awkward anymore. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato.
Did you feel that? I felt the organist dissipate. And that little pause, we both went, mate, we're mates again. That's
And if you like what you've heard,
I might cry just a bit.
And if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Right, thanks for listening, folks, and, well, we'll see you next time. Ta-da.